How do you bring your own war experiences to a collection of short stories? Phil Clay will talk to us about his new book, Redeployment.
It's an attempt to think about what it's like to be a mortuary affairs Marine, processing the bodies of the dead and then coming back.
What role has the U.S. played in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? John Judas is here to talk about his latest book, Genesis, Truman, American Jews, and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict.
We need to create a deal, an arrangement that's fair not only to the Israelis, but the Palestinians.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Phil Clay joins us now. He is the author of a new collection of short stories, Redeployment, which is reviewed on our cover this week by Dexter Filkins. In his review, Dexter Filkins says it is the best thing written so far on what the war did to people's souls. Hi, Phil.
How are you?
Good. So this is a been an exciting week for you. The book just came out. It was reviewed by Michiko Kakutani very favorably in the daily section of the paper, and I think you can safely call this a rave review by Dexter Filkins in the book review. How long were you working on the collection?
I started the first story in 2008, not that long after I got back from Iraq. So I worked on it for about 4 years.
The collection. The first story was published in Granta in 2011.
Yes.
And were other stories in the collection published before the book came out?
So Granta published two stories, OIF in their online section and then Redeployment. And then Tin House published a story called After Action Report.
And we should say you got back from Iraq. Tell listeners about what you did there. You're a former Marine.
I was a public affairs officer. I was a staff officer. So it's sort of an interesting job in that I got to spend a lot of time with a lot of different types of Marines, soldiers, sailors, went to a lot of different parts of Anbar province in Iraq. So I had a group of Marine combat correspondents who worked for me. If you've seen Full Metal Jacket, Joker is a combat correspondent, a great group of guys.
That's a Matthew Modine
right character.
Okay.
I advised the general on media issues. I coordinated with reporters who were coming in and sometimes escorted them.
So you know how to deal with us.
This is not my first time.
Just rewind a little bit because tell us how you got there to start with. You went to Dartmouth as
yes.
an undergrad. Did you know that you were going to enter the Marines, or were you in the Marines before that? How does this timeline play out?
I didn't go to college thinking that I was going to end up in the Marine Corps, and I think if you told me that I was, I would have been very surprised. One of my older brothers had joined the Marine Corps, and I started thinking about it very seriously in the run-up to the Iraq War. I guess part of my thinking was, it was an important historic moment. Regardless of political opinions, we were going in, and the choices that would be made there would have huge consequences. And I felt that I wanted to put myself in a position where I'd have responsibility to hopefully try and affect things for the better.
And before that point, did you know that you wanted to be a writer? Were you studying writing at Dartmouth or English?
I studied English and writing and history and. I always wrote. I was always a big reader.
And while you were over there, were you writing? Were you taking notes about the stories of fellow soldiers?
I wrote a little bit, and it was just god-awful stuff. I don't think you have the brain space to write anything intelligent. But I did keep notes, and I read a lot. I read Don Quixote and Gravity's Rainbow and most of A Dance to the Music of Time. And a bunch of other things, Amy Hempel.
Was there anything that you read that made what you were seeing and experiencing over there make more sense in some way?
I don't know. I mean, it's peculiar reading Gravity's Rainbow when you're in an environment like Iraq. However, but the thing was, when I was there, the violence was actually going down.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things helped, but it took me a lot of time to make sense of what had happened. I think the process of writing this book was important. I came back with a lot of ideas about what Iraq had meant, but over time, I realized that a lot of the ideas that I had were wrong.
And you entered into an MFA program.
Yes.
Was that with the express idea of, okay, I want to take these experiences and somehow make something of it? Or did you know that this was going to be what you would be working on, what you would come out with?
I didn't have the full shape of the book in my mind. I knew that there were questions I had.
What were the questions?
I could formulate them now, but I think probably better than I could back then. You know, back then it was just, what the hell was that? Not just what was that experience overseas, and not just my experience, because I was,
right,
you know, very much interested in the experience of a lot of the sort of different Marines and soldiers. Just a, but also, what does it mean for us when we're as citizens back in,
right,
the United States? Because it's a very peculiar place that we're in right now as a country, where you've got such a small percentage of the population that goes over and such little sense that we're at war.
And you're a writer in Brooklyn now, which is probably not a population that has a major overlap with veterans from the Iraq War, although I know that there are some people who are now.
You'd be surprised. There's a good community of vet writers in New York, and finding those people, folks like Jacob Siegel and Roy Scranton and Perry O'Brien and Matt Gallagher, was very important for me writing the book. Finding vet writers who were concerned about this, and then also finding civilian writers who could offer me the sort of perspectives from outside of the veteran point of view that could help me get a little bit of distance.
You mentioned that it was not just about the experience over there, but the experience in coming back. And the book, it seems, is in large part about that, even the title, redeployment.
There's still people dying over there. And you get out, and it's very easy to live a life where you're not at war. There's no sense that you're at war. And yet you know people who are going over. And every once in a while, you find out that something bad has happened to them. You know, we talked about alienating. I remember being in a coffee shop in Greenpoint, you know, and getting one of those phone calls. And I think that trying to work through what that means for us was certainly a part of the, it was one of the questions that I was trying to explore in that book.
You also write about, you know, the idea of how hard it is to then come back and sort of normalize. But it must have been especially hard with this war, because there was a constant cycling in and out, the redeployment that you,
right,
talk about, and part of the reason why it's was such a small group of people. Most Americans are not aware of the extent to which that redeployment was occurring. But when they were aware of it, obviously it was through the news, through newspapers. Does fiction offer a way to make that more real or more?
Absolutely. I mean, with fiction, you're putting yourself in those people's heads. For me, there is no other way to write this book. It's not thinly veiled memoir. It's fiction.
Right.
It's an attempt to think about what it's like to be a mortuary affairs Marine, going over, processing the bodies of the dead, and then coming back. What it's like to be an artilleryman who fires a mission, you know, his gun fires at a target and kills people, but he never actually sees the people that he's been a part of killing, and he tries to figure out what that means, or, you know, what it's like to be a psychological operations specialist. I mean, all these different things, and you know, when you read fiction, you inhabit those perspectives,
right?
Which is, I think, tremendously valuable and important to think about, particularly now that there's such a disconnect.
Does it seem to you that many people were not aware of it on a daily basis, of the Iraq War as it was going on? Do you feel like people, that this has sort of slipped out of people's consciousness, this, the experience of these soldiers and what continues to go on in Iraq?
I was talking to a reporter, Quill Lawrence, in NPR, and he was talking about how he'd gone over to Afghanistan to cover the war, then came back and, you know, a couple months later found himself referring to the war in Afghanistan as if it was over.
Right.
And he said, you know, something along the lines of, like, if I'm doing that and I was just there, what does this mean for the rest of us? I mean, I think that, I understand it's depressing and it's complicated to think about, but it's also vitally, vitally, morally important. You know, it's if we are apathetic as a country about the wars, then we shouldn't be surprised if we have an aimless war policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that we definitely owe the men and women that we send over is very serious thought about how we're, you know, using their lives. And we also owe a lot of serious thought to the people in the countries that we're, that we're fighting in.
I think we can end, but not end, on that note. Phil, thank you so much for coming in and talking about your new collection,
thank
Redeployment.
You.
The book is by Phil Clay, and it's reviewed this week on the cover of the Book Review by Dexter Filkins. Thanks again.
Thank you.
John Judas is a senior editor at the New Republic and the author of a new book called Genesis: Truman, American Jews, and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. He joins us now. John, hi.
Hi.
Thank you for coming and talking about the book. This book is both a history and it's also an argument book. You very much have make an argument that has contemporary implications. Let's start with the argument behind the book and then we'll back into the history. What is it that you are saying about the origins of the Arab-Israeli conflict and the implications of that argument today?
I guess the what I'm saying is that there were two sets of events that happened in the last 120 years that were central to this conflict. One set of events we know about a lot, and that was the Holocaust in Germany, coupled with the closing off of immigration in the West, which really made it necessary for European Jews at that point to seek a safe haven in Palestine. The other event was Zionism itself coming to Palestine, a country, a region, a territory that in the 1890s was about 95% Arab, Christian, and Muslim. Arabs had a long lineage there, thousands of years, and the Arab Muslims from 600 CE. What happened was that the Zionists in the 1890s didn't simply seek to emigrate there and practice a religion, but to create a Jewish state where another people were already living. That put the Arabs there in a difficult situation, and the grievances from that act and from its consequences have lived on. The establishment of Israel itself, in many ways, answered the crimes of the Holocaust. It was a way of responding to them. But the initial occupation, the initial attempt to create a Jewish state where another people lived and where they end up, with not only with no state at all, but living in refugee camps, occupied territory, and so on, really has not been addressed. And I think one of the messages of the book is that as we proceed now, we need to address that, and we need to create a deal, an arrangement that's fair not only to the Israelis but the Palestinians.
So let's go back to the main period that you talk about, although it kind of comes about halfway into the book, which is Truman and his role and the role of the American Zionist movement and the sort of competing forces between what the Palestinians wanted, what the British wanted, what the Americans wanted, what Truman wanted, and what the State Department under Truman wanted. How did that process take place? I mean, the way you look at it, it sounds like you see it as a lost opportunity, that something different could have happened during that
period.
Well,
I think I say at the very end of the book that the events were pretty much inevitable. There were times along the way in 1929 and late 1946 where things could have been slightly different, but no, I don't believe that. I think that Truman, when he recognized that Israel really had no choice, and if he hadn't recognized it on May 14th, he would have recognized it on June 1st. That's not the argument of the book. I mean, what surprised me about Truman in going through his papers was that he remained very conflicted about what he was doing. He had serious qualms, and even a day after he recognized the State of Israel, he was writing to someone and saying that, I wish that this plan we'd had to work out a federated Palestine with the Arabs and the Jews had worked out.
And that was the Morris Grady plan?
Yes.
Explain what that plan was and why it did not succeed.
The plan was to have a federation with an Arab part a Jewish part and then a joint legislature. And one of the keys to the plan was that the British would remain, and they would be in charge of such things as foreign policy until such a time as the Arabs and Jews could get along amicably, and then they would leave. Truman had to finally drop it, largely because of political pressures. Election was coming up in 1946, and the Democrats were really worried about losing the Congress, which they ended up doing. He just gave up in August of 1946 and never really returned to it in any practical way, though he kept telling people privately that that was his preferred solution.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it ever could have worked out myself. The only way he could have achieved any kind of federation or binational state or even any kind of partition at the time that was fair to both sides would have been for American troops to go in there and enforce it. And maybe even then it would not have worked. I actually say this in the book. I think that Truman's own option, what he preferred, was unrealistic in the end. The lesson I took from that was that there were two principles that guided him that I thought were relevant now.
Mm-hmm.
And the first was that he thought that any agreement or settlement had to be fair to both sides. It was a moral standpoint on his side. And secondly, he thought that if it wasn't fair, what would happen would be you'd have war, rebellion, and chaos for decades. And that's exactly what's happened. I think in that sense, Truman was on to something.
You talk about the sort of conflicting views that Truman had on Israel and on the founding of Israel, but also there wasn't consensus within his administration. Talk a little bit about how he dealt with the State Department and with Dean Acheson and what you write about there.
From the time Truman takes office in April of 1945 until August 1946, when the Morrison-Grady plan is shot down, when he gives up on it, he's pretty actively involved, and he has a plan, which is to allow the Jewish refugees from Europe into Palestine and at the same time create a state that would be a federation and fair to both sides. He really gives up at that point on his own plan. And what you find is that he withdraws and then he comes back and he withdraws and then he comes back. He gives the issue to the State Department. The State Department gets into a big fight with the Zionist movement and sometimes with the British. And then Truman has to come in at the last moment and intercede. So he doesn't, it's not an example of the buck stopped here, as you might say, of Truman's Cold War policies. It's an example more of withdrawal indecision.
You also delve into very controversial waters here when you talk a little bit in the book, or a lot, about the growth, the development of the Zionist lobby in the United States. Let's talk a little bit about Brandeis and his role in the American Zionist movement and how that affected Truman's.
Well, Brandeis was enormously important. He was a secular Jew, and he became convinced of Zionism's rightness in the, it was probably 1911, 1912, and then he became the, during World War One, the leader of the main Zionist organization in the United States. And even after he became a Supreme Court judge, he was very important behind the scenes. What struck me about Brandeis's role, and I think this is also true of the other founders of the Zionist movement in America, was that they were very outspoken liberals among the leaders of American progressivism. But that when they looked at Palestine and what was happening there, they really didn't take the situation of the Palestinian Arabs seriously. During the 1930s, Brandeis even advocates moving the Palestinian Arabs out in order to create a Jewish majority state. They would go to Iraq and Jordan. These are the kind of things that I think in another context, you couldn't imagine them doing or advocating.
Right.
So I think that there's a certain paradox there in terms of the liberal leadership of the Zionist movement.
I think you mentioned that Brandeis saw this as a replay of the sort of pilgrims and the American Indians.
You find that the metaphor coming up continually in among American Zionists, the idea that Zionists who were emigrating to Palestine were like the pilgrims or like the early American colonists, and that the Arabs were like the Indians, and the wars that were being fought or the riots were like the American Indian wars of the 18th, 19th century.
So when you talk about the conflict in that ideal between this liberal American vision of a progressive Jewish state and then what in actuality happened there, obviously, this takes us right up to the current day. I'm curious, I mean, just this week in the Times on the op-ed page, there's an editorial that says, you know, it comes right down to the fact that the Palestinians refuse to they recognize a state, but they will not recognize a Jewish state, and that the Israelis will never compromise on the right of return. Was there an awareness back during this period that this was the fundamental conflict? Did they see it in was it always in those terms?
I think that depended upon the political faction among the Zionists. There was a small dissenting group that included people later like Albert Einstein and Martin Buber and a guy named Judah Magnus, who was the founder of the Hebrew University, who always thought that you could have a binational state. Hannah Arendt was involved in that, too. Then I think the labor Zionists, out of which Ben-Gurion came, were always divided about it. They had a certain hope that the Palestinians, a lot of them came out of the socialist movement, that the Palestinian Arab workers would somehow come over to their side and that they could build a state with them. The revisionists, Jabotinsky, the people that eventually become Harut and then the Likud party and the Netanyahu father and son, had a much, much more unforgiving view of what was going on. And they really thought that that the only way to create a state was to build what Jabotinsky called an iron wall between the Jews and the Arabs.
Having gone back and looked at this period and obviously at its contemporary repercussions, do you find yourself thinking, if only X would have happened, or if only now we could do Y? Obviously, it's not an easy problem, but is there something that you see would help the situation that's not being done or that wasn't done back then?
As I say, when you look at the whole history, there were times when the window was open, but it was only opened very little. And I think in the end, it's hard to imagine other outcomes, especially when you get the immigration closed off and the Nazis taking power. I think that really closes whatever window that was open. Now, sure, I see options, and I think that I applaud what John Kerry is doing, and I hope that the Obama administration gets behind him and tries to create a settlement that's fair between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Well, it's obviously a very complicated history and controversial as much back then as it is and continues to be today. John, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was John Judas, author of Genesis, Truman, American Jews, and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. Greg Coles joins us now with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
We've got four new titles on the hardcover fiction list this week, starting right at the top. Kim Harrison has a new novel in her Hollows series. It's called The Undead Pool. Are you familiar with these books, the Hollows books?
No. Is it vampires or witches or wolves?
Essentially, I mean, it is urban fantasy. It is a witch, Rachel Morgan. She's the heroine of the series. It's a pretty funny, pretty entertaining urban fantasy series. The concept, it's set in a world where genetically modified tomatoes have wiped out a big chunk of humanity.
I knew that's what would do it.
Then at number three, there's a book called The Chase. It's by Janet Ivanovich, longtime bestselling regular, and Lee Goldberg. This is the second book in a series that they started, the Fox and O'Hare series, not the Fox and the Hare.
An easy mistake to make.
And so it's a sequel to a book called The Heist that they wrote together. So Janet Ivanovich branching out now, working with a co-writer.
Alrighty.
Then at number seven, Joanne Fluke, another series novel. This is called Blackberry Pie Murder. And this is part of her Hannah Swenson series about a baker in Minnesota who kind of stumbles into various crimes and solves them. My predecessor in the bestseller column, Jenny Schuessler, once baked Hannah's Viking cookies for the book review.
Right, because the recipes are included in the book.
Yeah, exactly right.
So, blackberry pie, everybody. All right.
And then finally on the hardcover fiction list at number 13, the short story writer Laurie Moore, her new collection, Bark. It's her first collection in 16 years. It was just reviewed on the cover of the book review by David Gates. She's very much considered a writer's writer. She's truly a literary writer, but it's not her first time on the list either. Each of her last three books, Bark now is on the list. Her previous book was the novel, A Gate at the Stairs.
That was 2009?
Yeah, and that spent 3 weeks on the hardcover list as well.
And that was reviewed also on her cover by Jonathan Lethem.
Yeah, that's right. And her previous collection, which came out all the way back in 1998, Birds of America, really a masterpiece of a book. It's, mm-hmm. it's really a great collection of stories. That hit the list for 3 weeks as well in 1998.
Well, very different from our other newcomers to the list this week.
That's right. And on the nonfiction side of things, there's only one new title. It is also right at the very top, new at number one. The science writer and futurist, he's kind of a visionary theoretical physicist, Michio Kaku, has a book called The Future of the Mind. And what he does is he looks at recent experiments in neurology and physics, theoretical physics, looking at the research that's been done and projects it forward to ask what might be capable. So he imagines things like projecting our minds into robots in outer space so that we can see what it's like to live in a different star system. He looks at wiping out memories and implanting new ones, which is already being done in rats in the lab. And so he says it's possible to do it in humans, too. He says in this book that a lot of what holds us back from doing these things with humans, because the science is already there, is bioethicists who say, well, this is tampering with nature and you can't do it. His response to this, he appeared recently on the podcast Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, and he said, it would really help if bioethicists read a lot more science fiction, because science fiction kind of points the way to what's possible.
It's an unusual book, really, to debut at number one. He was on The Daily Show or Colbert? Or
yeah, of course, TV has drives sales, as it often does. It's maybe not as unusual as you think. This is he's kind of like the speculative version of Malcolm Gladwell. It's kind of looking at what's going on in academia and translating it into people's everyday lives. And then he's a real science positive person. He's not scared of the possibilities of technology. He's kind of a Ray Kurzweil type of futurist who just says, wow, look at all this stuff that's so cool that we can imagine doing. And so there's a big audience for that.
Being telepathic, I knew that's what you would say. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.